You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
Hello, this is Barbara Barry, and this is The Fabulous Invalid.
Welcome to The Fabulous Invalid, a Broadway-centric podcast where we take an in-depth look at the theater through interviews with actors, writers, directors, designers, and everyone in between. I'm Jamie Dumont, recovering Broadway marketer, personal chef, and event planner.
I'm Rob Russo, writer and theater critic with StageLeft.nyc.
And I'm Jennifer Smard, currently appearing on Broadway in Mean Girls.
Hi.
Hello.
Yay. Well, boy, today we have a very special show. As Jennifer prepares to go into rehearsal for Company, we thought it might be a fun idea to have Barbara Barry on the show.
Squeeze.
And for those who don't know, Barbara Barry originated the role that Jennifer is going to be playing in Company, which is the character of Sarah.
Oh, my God. I'm so excited, you guys.
We're excited for you.
Thank you.
Really. As we've said before, and we will say again, this is thrilling.
Yeah, well, I'm going to do my best to, you know, to honor her and this legacy of a production. I'm really excited to be a part of it. Very honored.
And as part of that, you're going to be taking a little bit of a hiatus from the pod.
Yes, because as you know, when you're putting up a new show, the hours are going to be such that I won't be able to join you for a bit. I'm going to hang up my skates for the winter, but for the podcast skates anyway.
There you go.
But then
putting on different skates.
Yeah, but I'll see you when I can.
Yeah. We'll see you opening night. It's almost
see you opening night.
We will see you opening night.
That's
for sure. That's a date.
Some of our listeners will not, but they will. We will welcome you back with open arms once you're up and running.
Thank you, my friends.
Ready to come join us.
Thank you, and thank you for your love and support and understanding. And I'm really excited.
Yeah. Oh, of course. I mean, I don't know if we can assume this title, but I'm gonna try to claim it. We're your biggest cheerleaders.
You really are. Yeah. Those flowers you sent me. They sent me, those of you who don't know, I posted it on Instagram, but they, and you should follow us at Fabulous Invalid. They sent me beautiful flowers to my dressing room, and everyone who came in complimented them. You have great, great taste as well as generosity.
Oh.
But,
that was all Rob. I had nothing to do with it.
Well, I know, but you...
I was like, one black rose is what she gets.
That's, well, you know, I love that.
You would actually like that.
Actually, that's kind of on brand, let's be honest. But let's get around to you know who, because
I think it's time to
woman of the hour. Woman of the year.
Yeah.
If we can.
I'm coming out of my skin, you guys. I am. I'm so excited.
Well, Barbara Barry has been in 11 Broadway shows over the course of her career, including two Neil Simon plays. 1995's After Play, and most recently in 2017 in Josh Harmon's Significant Other. But of course, as I mentioned, we all know her from originating the role of Sarah in 1970's landmark musical, Company.
I can't wait to get into that with her.
Oh my gosh, yeah. We could talk Company for days, and I'm sure we will.
I think we will. But but also, I'm going to have to bring up a couple of her film roles, because she has starred in over 30 roles, including her iconic turn as Judy Benjamin's mother in Private Benjamin, which if you have not seen that film in a while, put it on, because it holds up.
Really love that.
It is Eileen Brennan, Goldie Hawn. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
But she was also nominated for an Academy Award for Best Featured Actress in 1979's Breaking Away, which is also another film that holds up. It's a little funnier because, you know, some of the 70s, you know, don't hold
admit,
up.
I'm going to admit it here, but I won't say it in front of Barbara. I've never seen it.
Yeah, we're going
to
change that.
We'll change that. I got to get that on my list.
It's a great coming of age story. And there's a moment in the film I think is probably one of the reasons she was nominated for an Academy Award, and I'm certainly going to ask her about it. But funnily enough, and I remember that she was a part of this, but in doing a little bit of research on her, which I didn't have to do a lot of, I learned that she's most known, or she says that the role that she's most identified with, the thing that people come up to her the most and recognize her for, is playing Barney Miller's wife on Barney Miller.
It was on Thursday nights, I think.
I guess. Yeah. It wasn't even, you know, it was Barney Miller was a landmark show for many reasons. And as she said in an interview that I was listening to, it was the first sitcom that took place in one room.
I guess they never left the room.
Yeah, they never left the precinct, which is I was shocked at. And that's, you know, it didn't run long, but it certainly made an impact. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it was only 4 or 5 seasons. All this talk about Barbara Barry, let's talk to her.
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it.
It's the little things you do together.
Aww.
Harry.
Huh?
Do you want to stand there?
Okay. I'm standing here. Now what?
Darling, just come at me.
Okay.
Today we are delighted to have Barbara Barry join us. Thank you so much for coming down.
You're welcome. Tell me your name again.
I'm Jennifer Simard.
And you've been in Mean Girls?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. For all this time?
My friend Carrie Butler originated it and left after 6 months to do Beetlejuice, and I've been doing it for the last year.
Mm-hmm. Has it been fun?
It's been a blast. I love it. It's a show about the kids, you know, and I love seeing them rise up, and I love my part because I just get to be, you know.
What part are you playing?
I'm the middle-aged character actress, so I do the teachers. I do Ms. Norbury, and then the blonde, the mom, Mrs. George, you know.
When I saw you were in the show?
I was in the show, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then Lauren gave us a backstage tour,
she did.
You know.
Yeah, I know.
And Mabel, my granddaughter, mm-hmm. really is Peter Pan. I mean, that's all she wants to do is dance and sing and make movies. And she's just totally headed toward the stage. There's
I wonder
no
where
question.
She gets it.
No. Well, you know, my husband was a director and her uncle is a lyricist. And it's in your DNA, yeah. I think.
And your son's a producer, correct?
Yeah, my son's a producer.
So it is definitely a family affair.
I guess so, but it's a hard life.
I think I met you. I did a show off Broadway called I Love You, You're Perfect, Now Change. And I think I met you after that 25 years ago.
Oh, my God.
But I have
did
to
my
ask.
Son produce it? Who produced it?
Well, Jamie Hammerstein produced it. Oh. I've been crediting you with something I heard that they said that you said, and I use it sometimes when I'm tired.
What did I say?
That you always have to have your second best performance in your back pocket.
Yeah, well, I did, but not when I saw you.
No, but I think I brought it up that night. I was like, I think this is something she said, and I use it to.
It's not even original with me. I've forgotten who said it.
Oh, really?
Well, you have to, because you can't be on every night.
Yeah. You have to
we did company for a year, you know. We were so tired. We were all so tired. We had, we were all with little kids. We all had little kids.
Wow.
We're so tired.
Tough show to do, huh?
8 times a week.
Yeah.
And then I would bicycle home and cook dinner. I mean, I don't want to go into it. You want to start this, right?
You bicycled home every night from the theater?
Yeah, we lived on West End Avenue. Not every night, no. I bicycled home on the matinee days because I had 2 little children and I had a nanny who didn't cook. And my husband was rehearsing. He has his own company. And so I would get on my bicycle after the matinee, bike up to West End Avenue, cook dinner, and sometimes bike down. Or if the weather was bad, I would take a subway home. I said, subway back.
Would you bike up 9th? How would you go?
Yeah.
9th?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I was a city cyclist for a long time.
Days. What?
I bicycled. I commuted by bike for about 10 years. And but this was in the 90s. You were way ahead of the curve.
Yeah, I took the kids to nursery school on a bike.
You're kidding.
No, I had a seat on the back, and I took the older one until she went into the first grade, and I took Aaron until he went into the first grade. I just lived a few blocks from the school, but I took them on the bike, and we didn't wear helmets in those days.
No, not at all.
It's a wonder I'm still here.
Was it a Schwinn? Do you remember?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Right. We ride them now all the time. You know, we live on Fire Island half the year, so we're all big bike riders. But I don't remember what that was. But people thought I was crazy. You know, I would ride up with this kid in the back. But it was, it's made perfect sense to me.
Yeah. What's the fastest way?
I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like.
I'm beside myself, as I've been a fan of yours for so long, and I'm going to get into more of that a little bit later, of what made me really, really admire you as a comedic actress. But since I'm going into company, do you have any advice for me? That's kind of a broad question.
No, because I don't know who you're going to be working with. I don't even know who's directing. Who's directing?
Marianne Elliott. She directed the London production that is coming over, and she directed Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, War Horse, the most recent revival of Angels in America. And I was very excited.
Oh, she did that one?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So she's really good, right?
She is really good. I was really fond of her at my audition.
I have no advice, because you're going to have a whole different experience from ours.
Yeah.
I mean, we were really pioneers, you know. We didn't know what we were doing. And neither did Hal Prince.
Well, and I heard in an interview somewhere that you said that you got to choose your role. And how did that come about?
Because he sent me the script. He said, pick a role. Pick whatever you want.
Hal Prince said that to you. So cool.
Did you have to, were you thinking between characters, or was it Sarah from the beginning?
It was Sarah from the beginning, because I'm so physical and I wanted to do that.
You wanted
physical,
to karate.
Right.
Yeah.
But I may have not chosen it had I realized I was not going to have a song. Because Charlie Kimbrough and I did have one song at the beginning, The Little Things You Do Together. We were in that group, and he took us out of that group. So then I had nothing to sing except Poor Baby. I was in mm-hmm. Poor Baby. Mm-hmm. But I, he said, choose what you want. And that was the part I wanted.
And did you ask for a song, or?
No, never occurred to me to do that. Because all they wanted at the audition was for me to sing. Because they knew me, you know, Hal knew me, knew my husband, my brother-in-law, everybody knew everybody, and Steve wanted to hear me sing. So I sang a song that David Craig coached me on. He's somebody way before your time, you don't know who that is. And then they said, okay, the part is yours, you're fine, you're singing. I said, wait, I've worked on the scene, and I had worked on the scene with an actor named Terry Kaiser. And we had worked very carefully on the scene. And I did the scene, and it was more or less what I ended up doing on the. And they said, oh, my God. No, they said, you don't have to do a scene. You don't have to do a scene. Just go home. I said, no, no, I want to show you the scene. And I did the scene. Jerry and I did it together. It was great.
Oh, gosh, I would kill to see video footage of that. I would love to see it.
It was in a school. We had the audition was in a school somewhere. I don't remember. But I was determined to show them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, after I got the part, I called Hal and I said, I'm taking karate lessons and you're going to pay for it. He said, what? I said, I found a wonderful teacher and I'm going to take karate lessons and I'm going to send you the bill. And he sputtered and carried on. I said, Hal, this is really important. So I did it. I studied with this guy on Broadway, in a Broadway studio. I can't remember his name. He was very eccentric, but he taught me karate. And I studied for about, I guess maybe 4 months before we went into rehearsal, 3 months, whatever the time period mm-hmm. was. And I brought that, what I learned, to the rehearsal. And Michael Bennett adapted it, what I brought, to what we finally did. And they all thought I was crazy. I said, no, you're going to pay for it. I really, I knew what I was doing.
Yeah, well, I could have blocked that.
No, that can't be blocked.
You want to do it again?
Okay.
I'll come at you again.
Okay.
Did you always want to be an actor?
No.
No.
Not at all. I don't know what I wanted to be. I thought I should be a teacher because my father had died when I was 16, and I thought I should have a profession, you know. In those days, nobody offered you anything else. You could be a teacher or you could be an actress or you could be a physician, lawyer. It was never offered.
Right.
And so I thought I'd go to the University of Texas and study theater ed. I was interested in theater, but not in performing. And when I got there, I started getting parts in shows. And then I started acting a lot. And then I started really acting a lot. And I thought, well, this is not bad, but I'm going to be a teacher. So I started on my master's, and the faculty called me, and they said, you're not going to be a teacher. You're going to be an actress. I said, really? They said, yes, goodbye. You're leaving now. And they made me leave Austin. They said, you got to go out into the world. You can't stay here anymore. And I said, you know, they really said, you're going to be an actress. There's no question. So I thought, well, I guess I'll do it. And my boyfriend was here, so it was a reason to come. And I thought, well, if I do it, I'll do it. But he's here, you know. I wanted to be with him. So it was a very slow thing.
Was there a show that when it all clicked, were you performing in something when you thought, oh, this is what I'm meant to do?
That's a really good question. And I'll tell you exactly what it was. It was a Molière, and I was playing, you know, the always ingenue who's being kept by her uncle and who everybody wants. She doesn't want to marry the person he wants her to marry, and he's leching for her. I've forgotten which play it was. And I was at up in a balcony. The University of Texas had very elaborate sets because they had so much money. They still do. And then we had the set where I was on the balcony and I was saying something and they were kidding me because I always found my light. I just did it automatically. I was kind of going like that. And finally I said, I laughed at something. And I got a huge laugh from the audience. And I thought, what happened? And that was the moment. Yeah. I thought, I think this could be fun. I mean, it was really a laugh. And it was totally extempore, which is when I realized that acting was not exactly what we were being taught. We were being taught very specific kind of acting. And Rip Torn was in my class, and he used to say, I don't think this is the way to do it. He always used to say that. I don't think this is the way to do it. I think we're missing something. He always said that.
That's fascinating.
And they did their best with us, you know. They really did teach us. I came right to New York, actually, and started working. But he always said, there's something else going on. There's something else. But when I did that moment that was not rehearsed, you know, I didn't rehearse it.
Yeah.
And the house came down. I thought, oh, such a good question you asked, because that was the moment.
Well, I'm not an actor. Jennifer, you can attest to this better than I, but I think there's a moment, like that moment of making an entire theater laugh.
Oh,
that's
powerful. Oh, it's so.
Right? You've done that your whole career now, right?
It's so seductive.
Very good at it.
It's so seductive. Thank you.
It's seductive. That's a great word.
Now I want to know which play, Le Bourgeois Gentilhomme or the Miser. I'm trying to
think. I think it might be the Miser.
I'm trying to remember. Maybe the Miser.
Yeah.
There's always an ingenue who's being held captive in some way. And we did so many Molières, I've forgotten which one. But that was one where I was up in the balcony, and the lighting director, who was one of our professors, said to me afterwards, he said, I've never had a student. He said, I could put that light on your elbow and you would find it. So you're always finding the light. I had no idea I was doing it, you know. I just automatically.
Instinctual. If you're instinctual.
Right. I remember him too. I can't remember his name. But just incidentally, I'm going to Austin next month. This professor, one of my acting professors, is gone now, of course, is being honored with a 3-day festival. And they've asked me to come down and be one of the speakers. And I'm going and being. But, you know, I have my conflicts because at Texas University, it's concealed carry now. You can carry a gun anywhere. And I said, I'm not going to go. And then I thought, well, a lot of the stuff is going to be off campus. But I wanted to honor him, so I'm going. But I'm so disappointed in my university. We have something like 33 campuses. You can carry a gun on every single one. They offered me, you know, I was on the short list for the most famous alumnus of the year, and I said, take me off the list. I wouldn't take the award if you gave it to me, because I think it's so horrible what you're doing. And they said, all right, Miss Berry, we will take you off the list permanently. I got a letter back.
Oh, my.
Well, good. You have to stand up for what you believe in.
I really do.
We chatted with Len Carew a while ago, actually recently, and he told us a story about when he first got the script and the score for A Little Night Music and when he first read one of his songs. And it was a very engaging story about him realizing sort of the magic that was on the page. And I wonder, since you were in a similarly magical show company, when you got the script, the George Firth script with a Stephen Sondheim score, when you read through it and you were looking to see what character you wanted to play, did you know what was going on the page?
Didn't have a clue. There were separate scenes. So, you know, when you're offered a part or a script, you know, you look at your part. And I thought, I've got to find my part. Because Sal said, read it and tell me what you want to play. So I was reading. Even when we were in rehearsal, at the old Jerry Robbins studio on 18th Street. Hal and I had trouble from the beginning, but when I went up to him one day and I said, what is this musical about? And he said, I do not have a clue. And really, I'm not kidding, he said, I don't have a clue. It became a musical about marriage as we worked on it, but we never discussed that it was about marriage. We discussed, you know, the contingencies of doing that musical. It was very hard, all those dances. And I mean, Side by Side was 14 minutes in Boston.
Yeah.
And he said, I don't know what it's about. And I think more or less the public told him what it was about. I don't think he knew it. And I don't think George did either. Those things came from various things he had written.
Right. Yeah, they were sort of brought together to make one piece, right?
Don't think George knew.
So when you say that the audience informed what the play became, you mean when you were on the road, when you were at the Colonial in Boston, and as you were developing it, the audiences are what helped shape what we know as the show.
I'm speaking for them. We did was our work. Right. You know, we just did the work. It was overwhelming.
Right.
I mean, it was exhausting. And once more, I had two children with me out of town, little babies in the hotel room. You know, I mean, I couldn't think about what it was. I just did my work. We all did our work. We never sat down and had a philosophical discussion about this play.
That's interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, you think.
These days it would be very intense and we would talk about, but we didn't do it then.
There would be whole labs about what the meaning is and. But you sort of slyly said, I think, that you and Hal butted heads a little bit in the process.
We did, yes. Yes, we did. For many reasons and many things. And it's too boring to go into them. But we clashed over certain things. And, you know, he would accuse me of being, you method actress, you. One time we had a horrible fight in Boston, a really horrible fight. And I left the stage in tears. It was a rehearsal. And he apologized at the end of the day. My husband also happened to be visiting and was in the room when Hal came in. And he finally told me that day, he said, you know what it is? He said, Elliot Norton's review had come out. He was the big Boston critic then. And he didn't like it. And he certainly didn't like the ending number, which we eventually changed. Only person he liked was me, and I didn't know it. And I didn't know why Hal was so angry with me. He was angry with me all day, but he explained it at the end of the day. This is why he said, it's irrational of me to have done it, but you're the only person he really liked it. And then they changed the ending number because Elliot Norton didn't like it.
And that's when it became Being Alive?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he apologized. And at the very end, after almost a year, my last night, my very last night, I came down, my last exit before the curtain call, I came down, and he was waiting at the foot of the stairs backstage with flowers. And he said, usually when actors do a long, long run, they get worse and worse and worse and worse. And he said, I know now how you work, and you just got better and better and better and better. So I said, thank you so much.
Well, you've mentioned just a minute ago how physically grueling the show was. And I was reading recently that Michael Bennett referred to the opening number as the most difficult piece he'd ever done for actors. Obviously, you know, he choreographed great dances, but the physicality of the opening number of the show.
Oh, it was terrible. And and to learn it vocally was unbelievable. You know, my husband was not only a singer, but a theater producer, and he was the founder of TheaterWorks. And he was a brilliant musician. And I don't read music. And so after a few days, I took the score home, and I said, I don't know how to learn this. And because Steve said, I'm not coming in the room until you all know it. Until you know it, I'm not listening to it. So we were afraid. I mean, they all knew how to read music. I didn't know how to read music. So I took it home to my husband. We had a big grand piano in our living room. And we put the kids to bed, and he sat down with me, and he went over every single entrance and exit I had, every vocal entrance, every note, what I sang. And we worked about 2.5 hours steadily. And at the end, and he had been in many Broadway musicals, he said, this is the hardest opening number I have ever seen in my whole life, the hardest vocal number I've ever seen. And that, I mean, he was really experienced. And he sang like a birdie, too. He could sight read, too. He could sight read anything. And he sight read that score. He said, let me look at it. And then he sang it for me. So it was easy for him. And so finally I learned that night. We went back and we had another rehearsal. And the music director was Hal Hastings. And after we did it, he said, Barbara, I bet you worked with your husband last night. I said, I did. He said, I can tell you did homework. If it weren't for Jay, I wouldn't have learned it. I mean, somebody would have learned. But I have to tell you this. You've probably heard the story. You know, the score was on a cardboard, big cardboard pieces of paper. And it, when you rolled it out, it made a noise. And it was so long that the pages were at the end of the room. We would roll it out of the and Elaine Stritch, she couldn't learn it. She said, wait till they try to do this shit in stock. I mean, we all had trouble. And we had two brilliant singers in there. Pamela
Myers
could sing anything, and she had trouble.
Yeah.
And the rest of us were actors. We weren't singers. So, it's the worst, the hardest thing most people had ever seen. And then we had to learn to dance to it.
Right. Michael Bennett dancing, right? Like Michael Bennett's choreography. So it's.
And he was a taskmaster.
I bet.
You better get it right or he'd move you to the back of the line. It was just terrible. It was hard. The whole thing was hard.
Well, you've got Stephen Sondheim, Harold Prince, Michael Bennett. Those are some heavy hitters.
Yeah, but you know, we were just hired hands to do a job. I mean, we didn't want to be yelled at.
Right. Nobody wants to be yelled at. which makes me, talking about learning the score, I can't not bring up the legendary 18-hour recording session of the album, which was famously documented in film by D.A. Pennebaker. And you were clearly there that night. Recording.
I didn't want to be there, but I was there.
What do you remember about that night?
Well, because they paid us 1 week's salary for 22 hours work. And I said to them, because I was the only one who had done a lot of television, and I said, we are not being paid well for this. And what we should be getting is a week's salary. And they wouldn't pay us. And the union came down, and Hal got mad at me, and I felt that we were being exploited. But they were also eager to do it, you know.
Right.
That's why I wore dark glasses. I said, they wanted to interview me. I said, I'm not going to be interviewed. I think this is exploitation of actors. And I was very angry about it. And so, but I was there. But I was supposed to have had a huge part in it. And I said, I'm not doing it. You know, in this day and age, if this happened, it would be like Me Too. They'd say, oh, right, you know, right. She's a woman and she's saying that it's... Well, we got $147 for 22 hours of work.
That's crazy.
And I objected. Hal really never forgave me for it. He really never. Because he came down and said, what are you doing? The after came down because it was an after thing. And they didn't stand by us either. They were all timid. Well, you know, it's a big thing and you're going to. I was just so angry the whole day. And but anyway, you want to know about the recording? It was crazy.
Yeah.
And it was really fun. Elaine, of course, as you know, had a very hard time.
Yeah, yeah.
But eventually she became the star of the piece, so there.
I actually watched it last night.
You did?
I did. I own the DVD, and I thought, well, it doesn't take much for me to watch that. And, but I hadn't seen it in a while. And there's moments where, you know, and I didn't know Elaine Stritch very well. I knew her slightly, but I thought, is it Elaine being Elaine or is she frustrated? Like, it's very complicated when you watch her go through that whole trying to get her number at what, 4 o'clock in the morning or something insane. Like it's a really fascinating study or look at.
Well, she had issues, you know.
Well, yes. I mean, there's multiple things going on that evening.
As far as that night was concerned, you know, Elaine was very difficult. I never had a bad moment with her, ever. I just loved her. And I felt terrible for her that night because she was struggling. So, and people always said, well, you know, how did you get along? We got along just fine. And she was, there was nobody like her in the world. And you just took her with a grain of salt. You know, she also loved my children, which was helpful. She just loved them. And she loved my son. Aaron Harnick and Elaine Stritch had this running joke all the time, which is about writing for her. It's a long, boring story. But anyway, she had a very hard time. And I was so angry. I was there so long, and I felt, I'm sorry to be repetitive, but I felt we were being exploited. And we were.
Right.
And then Pennybaker took it and played it all over the world. Because he said, oh, we'll never make any money from this. You know, this is just for fun. Oh, yo, yeah. Don't talk to me about money. I get really...
Well, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but the film is considered one of the best documentaries about the theater ever made.
And everybody in it made $147.
I had no idea. Wow.
If he hears this, he doesn't like me either.
I told you earlier I'd circle back to something. So when I got this offer, I, of course, had to let my bosses at Mean Girls know that I was leaving. And I wrote a letter to Tina Fey and Casey Nicholaw telling them so. And I told them a story. I said, I have a story for you. I said, I grew up on a dead-end street.
Did you write this down?
I did. And yeah. I grew up on a dead-end street in Litchfield, New Hampshire. We didn't have a lot of access to Broadway. But in 1981, we got access to HBO. And I was 11 years old, and I sat down, and I watched a HBO televised version of Barefoot in the Park that was recorded in Seattle, starring you and Richard Thomas and Bess Armstrong. And I was watching with my girlfriends, and all my girlfriends wanted to be Bess Armstrong. I said, not me. I want to be that one. And I was pointing at you. And I taped it on my VHS tape, and I watched the scene at the top of Act Two where Paul carries his mother-in-law home over his shoulder. And my mother and I were watching together. I said, this is why it's funny. And I watched it over and over again because it's one of the best examples of the execution of someone who understands timing. I just fell in love with you in that moment. I said, this is one of the funniest actresses I've ever seen.
Isn't that a weird coincidence?
It's a weird coincidence. And when I got this, I was writing to them. I said, I can't even tell you what it means to me to recreate this role 50 years later of this woman that I admired before I even, you know, really knew I was a child.
Did she respond to you?
Oh, yeah. They just thought it was the coolest thing ever. They were thrilled for me. They absolutely understood.
After you saw that when you were living in New Hampshire?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Then where did you go to school?
Well, I went to the Boston Conservatory of Music when I was older.
So you really sing?
I do sing. I am a singer. But
she's got a great voice.
Yeah.
And then where did you go?
I came to New York. I got cast in Forbidden Broadway when I was 22 years old. And then, yeah.
God, you must be incredible.
And you've been working steadily ever since.
Yeah, working steadily ever since. But I actually sent them, my friends, Jamie and Rob, a clip of Neil Simon's script of how he wrote this line that your character had. Was, I feel like we've died. And he has ellipses.
Who did this?
This is Neil Simon in your play in Barefoot in the Park. And I sent my friends. I sent them the clip of you because there's a... you can find it.
Oh, I forgot. Yeah, he wrote
that. But you're wonderful. It's not really a question as much as a compliment, I'm realizing.
Thank you. But it was a lucky stroke, that whole show. It was really a good show. Yeah, it was just fun. And I don't even know why I was cast in it. Somebody called me up and said, you want to do it? I said, sure. But we went to Seattle to do that.
Yeah, yes.
And that was great fun because I'd never been to Seattle. Mm-hmm. And... It was everything I do seems to have controversy in it because Richard Thomas kept saying you're acting too small, your acting is too small, and I kept saying to Richard Thomas your acting is too big because it's a small screen we're going to be on, you know, so we had. I mean, it's always I've learned not to do that so much, but in my career has been. Because I have this thing about I'm right, you know, I'm right, you have to listen to me, which doesn't get me anywhere. It's stupid to do it. But that was a fun thing to do because the part is so good.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that With brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Do you think you can teach timing? Here's my question.
No.
People say you can't. I agree.
Oh, no.
I try to give examples when I teach my students, and I've shown that clip of you and he. I've shown a clip of Kevin Kline in A Fish Called Wanda. It's hard to teach if you can at all.
Where do you teach?
No, when I do Broadway workshops or when I, you know, kids, sometimes they can sign up for these Broadway classrooms.
Oh.
Maybe different student groups.
How many years were you at the Boston Conservatory?
Not long, only a semester.
So you didn't get a degree?
No, ma'am. I went to the Hunter College just for myself. I like to say I'm a
49. You mean after you got to New York, you went to Hunter?
Yeah, like 10 years in, I studied science and math and stuff other than theater while I was working.
What made you leave the conservatory so soon?
I got cast in shows, and I had to make a
choice. From Boston?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
I had friends who'd already moved to New York City, and they said, hey, they're auditioning here for XYZ. Do you want to try it? I said, sure, I'll come down on a lark.
And then it's so talented. She's very talented.
She's very talented.
I can't wait to see you in the show.
Oh my gosh. I'm beside myself. And we're opening on Sondheim's birthday on March 22nd.
On his 90th birthday.
On his 90th birthday.
Do you think they're going to invite the original cast?
I imagine they are.
I can say with great surety that you will get invited.
Well, I hope so, because I'd really like to be at that.
You will.
I'd really like to be at that.
I hope I don't disappoint you.
You know, some of us have gone.
I know.
I was thinking about that today. About Larry Kurt. And even Dean is gone, right? Dean Jones is gone.
Yeah. I think last year, right?
Look, you're a very special girl, not just overnight. No, you're a very special girl, not because you're bright. Not just because you're bright. You're just a very special girl, June.
April. Thank you.
I have to tell you, just because it's funny, I think, when we did the brownie thing, I said to Hal, I can eat this brownie and fall off the couch. And he said, no, you can't. How could you do that? I said, I can do it. And he said, it's too dangerous. And I said, just put a mattress in back of the couch, and I'll do it. And I did it. And I must say, I got a big laugh. And we kept it in. But he really fought me on it. He said, it's too dangerous. I don't want you to do it. I said, let me just try. And there are pictures of me with that. Have you ever seen that?
Oh,
with
absolutely.
The brownie going,
yes, yes. Oh no, I have pictures. I'm gonna be creepy. I have a picture of you blown up. It's gonna be framed in my dressing room.
No.
This is dedicated for you. I'm truly a fan. I cannot believe I get to do this.
And when do you start rehearsals?
January 6th.
Oh, not till then.
Yeah. So I'm taking class and learning the opening number.
Right?
From whom?
Oh my gosh, myself, I'm just playing the recording over and over and over again.
Oh, you mean vocally you're learning?
Yeah, I'm learning.
Because who knows what you'll do?
Yeah, I don't know which parts will happen.
Want to hear the other story about Michael Bennett?
Yes, we do,
yes,
of course.
Yes, we do.
I was, both my kids got what's called something itis in their lungs one night, in the middle of the night. Aaron was just 2 and Jane was 5. And Jay, my husband, Jay Harnick, was in Washington with his company, and I'm alone. And I have these 2 children with high fever. So I have one under one arm and one under the other arm. And I didn't want to call the pediatrician because it was 5 in the morning, 4 in the morning. So I waited, and I called him. And he said, Mrs. Harnick, come right to the office this minute, and I'll meet you there. He was the most incredible man. So I took these 2 kids, and I called Fritz Holt, who was the stage manager. And I said, Fritz, I'm going to the doctor with Jane and Aaron because they're both very sick, and Jay's in Washington, and I'm not going to be able to come to rehearsal until I get this settled. So I go to the office on 2 West 67, I'll never forget, and he takes both kids, and he's punching them with, you know, onto it. And he said, we got to get a nurse for them because you can't leave them alone today. You have to be... If you're going to go to work and Jay's not here, you have to. So I said, okay. So I called Fritz and I said, I have to get a nurse and I'm not sure where I'm coming. No, I didn't call him. He called. The phone rang. And Dr. Stone said, it's somebody named Fritz Holt. I said, what? They're checking on me to see if I was really there. Hmm. They were checking on me. I said, did you not believe me? He said, well, I'm just checking to see if everything's all right. I said, no, you're checking to see if I'm really here. I was so angry. Anyway, I said, I'll get there when I can get there. So I took them home. We got a registered nurse to come and take care of them. The nanny was coming later. I get to rehearsal at 2 o'clock, and we're doing side by side. And now, mind you, I've been up all night, right? All night. And I'm trying to do the middle. I didn't get it right. And Michael Bennett said to me, I put you in the middle of the stage, Barbara, and you haven't learned it yet. And I think, you know, I took him over to the side. I said, Michael, if I have to choose between this show and my children, guess what I'm going to choose? He said, leave me alone. I'll learn it when I learn it.
Isn't it warm? Isn't it rosy? Side by side.
He's such a cutie.
By side.
Isn't he a cutie?
Ports in a storm. Comfy and cozy.
Well, it's funny because, you know, I think us as, you know, speaking for myself as a fan of, you know, a show like Company, it's easy to forget that the creative process of creating something like that can be really difficult and really fraught. When we spoke to Donna McKechnie, she was talking about how when they did a chorus line originally, it was really hard. They didn't have fun doing a chorus line.
No.
Because they were creating it. You know,
that's right.
That's what I'm hearing from you is that, you know, it was really hard.
It's torturous. Yeah. You know, Beth Howland, mm-hmm. who did The Bride, she was in tears half the time, yeah. just sobbing because she couldn't get it right. And Steve kept saying to her, I don't care about the words. I care about the emotion. If I don't hear the words, it doesn't make any difference. Just sing it from your heart, you know. And she wanted it to, and she would just collapse.
Go, had you go? Why is nobody listening? Goodbye, go and cry at another person's wake. If you're quick for a kick, you could pick up a christening. But please, on my knees, there's a human life at stake. Listen, everybody, I'm afraid you didn't hear it. Do you want to see a crazy lady fall apart in front of you? It isn't only Paul who'll be ruining his life. You know, we'll both of us be losing our identities. I telephoned my analyst about it, and he said to see him Monday, but by Monday, he'll be floating in the Hudson with the other garbage. I'm not well, so I'm not getting married. You've been swell, but I'm not getting married. Clear the hall, because I'm not getting married. Thank you all, but I'm not getting married. And don't tell Paul, but I'm not getting married today.
Somebody, forgotten who, Pamela, I think, had a fur coat, and they took the fur coat away from her at one rehearsal because they said, you're not going to wear that anymore. She sobbed. I mean, just, you know, we were struggling.
Yeah.
And we all had little kids. So we were home in the morning, and even with these little kids, we had seven of us. We're married with small children.
Wow.
We were tired. We were tired company. And we were in our 30s. We weren't in our 20s, you know. We were in our middle, late 30s, mm-hmm. dancing around like idiots. You know that in Boston, we did side by side, and you go out, and then you come back in, and then you go out. And we came back out, and Lane wasn't in the line. We said, where is she? She's not here. We went, she's sitting backstage in her little dressing. She had a little dressing coat. She said, I'm not going back out. So Al said, why not? She said, it's too fucking long and I'm not going back out. And they took her out. She disappeared, you know. It was 13 minutes long. We told jokes. We got up on boxes and told jokes in the middle of it. They took all that out. Yes, you're right. We were struggling.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, looking back on it, I guess it was, you know, must have been a great experience. Must have been.
One's impossible, two is dreary, three is company, safe and cheery. Side.
He always looks like he's keeping
by
score. Who's winning, Robert?
I personally can't sit here with you and not mention 1979's Breaking Away, which was a wonderful motion picture that won the Academy Award for Best Screenplay, and also you were nominated.
I was nominated.
For Best Featured Actor. There's a marvelous scene where you talk about your passport.
Yes.
You smiled as I said it because you knew what I was going to bring up. It's a beautiful, beautiful scene, just in film in general, but particularly between a mother and a son. It's really a beautiful moment. And do you have any thoughts on filming?
Would you like to know the story about that scene?
I would love.
Everybody brings that up.
Well, it's because it's a big moment in film.
I got the part. I met Peter Yates just at 20th Century Fox. We just talked. He said, you got the part. I said, you don't want to see anybody? I said, no, it's yours. I had just come in from New York the night before with my children. And I said, all right. He said, go home, we'll send you the script. That was how I got the part. And I loved it. I loved that script, you know. I didn't understand it either. I'm not a good script reader. When I read stuff, I don't get it. Like I do books and things. So they went to Indiana to start. And I'm studying the script at home. We were renting a house in Tarzana. And I was reading this, and I thought, there's not a scene between the mother and the son. There's a scene between the father and the mother, and a lot between the father and the son, but not between the mother and the son. And he's clearly a chip off my buck, you know? And I thought, why isn't there a scene? So I had their number in Indiana, and I called. And I talked to Steve Desich, and I said, I don't really want to complain, but, you know, there's no scene between him and me. There's not even, we could be putting, you know, laundry into the washing machine, or we could be making a sandwich together, or we could pass in the hall. There's nothing between him and me. He said, really? I said, really? So it's inexplicable how he got these characteristics from me when you never see him with me. And he said, oh, I never thought of that. Well, let me work on it. So hung up the phone, and about 4 days later, I got a call from Indiana, and they said, we've written a scene. We want you to come to Indiana and look at it. So they sent me a ticket, and God knows what I did with the children in Tarzana, I guess Jay came or something, and I went to Indiana, went to this motel room with the headquarters, and they read me that scene, which is only about 8 lines long, I think.
Yeah, it's short.
And I said, well, that's just perfect. That's just perfect. And they said, you know, we're so glad you mentioned it. It would not have been in the movie if I hadn't mentioned it, because it was a clear absence of sensible script writing. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And they were so kind to do that. So we had a drink, we had dinner, and then I got on the plane and went back to California. So when we came to do it finally, a few weeks later, the dynamics of it, I won't bore you with the details, but, you know, the father is in the room, and I think he's sick, as I remember.
He's had a heart attack.
He's had a heart attack. And I, whatever my choices were, Peter Yates said, they're reversed. They're the wrong, you should do this here and this here instead of what you're doing. I said, oh, okay. And that's how we did it, I guess maybe in 4 takes. And everybody I meet talks about that scene.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you bring up a classic. I mean, I keep hearing this from talking to you that throughout your entire career, you've made a point to ask for what you want and what you need, which is, I think...
Is that true? Is that what I've done?
It's what it sounds like. You certainly sound like you have no trouble knowing when something's not working.
And I make enemies along the way.
Well, that, you know what, but...
But nothing you've said sounds ridiculous.
That's no, it all sounds perfectly sensible.
And in this instance, it was received really beautifully.
Maybe it's because it was then. If it did it now, women have a different place in the world now. Yeah.
But I think with that scene in particular, you're right. It's 8 lines or so, but it's really about how you deliver it. And it's really the moment between you and your son, I believe it's Dennis Christopher, it's what's not said that's so beautiful about that scene.
Well, that's the director. I'm telling you, he directed it so beautifully, because my choices would not have been the right choices. And he immediately said, you got to reverse what you're doing. And I knew exactly what he meant.
Yeah.
And Dennis did too, you know. So, but isn't it interesting? I meet people in European cities who talk about that scene.
Yeah.
And it was not in the original script.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Wow.
And he won the Oscar for the screenplay.
He won the Oscar for screenplay, yeah. It was nominated for Best Picture. I mean, that was a big year for film. You were up against Apocalypse Now and Kramer versus Kramer, and that was a China Syndrome.
Then right after that, a few years after that, Steve Tesich died.
Yeah, it's a shame.
It's terrible.
Yeah, it's a real shame. Well, you've been so lovely and generous with your time. I think I'm done with questions.
I have one question, if you'll indulge.
What?
If you know, much like Jennifer had such a formative experience seeing you in Barefoot in the Park, my first introduction to you on stage, at least, was Significant Other.
Really?
Which was for me, such an incredible play, and I was, you know, blown away by your performance. And there's a line in particular that has stuck with me.
I know what you're going to say. It's a long book.
It's a long book.
See, that's another thing. Everybody exactly I meet right. says, even if I don't know them, they say, this is Barbara Barry. It's a long
it's
book.
It's a long book, yes. Well, it's so poignant. You know, it's such a poignant
writing.
Way
it's
of...
It's the writing.
Right.
It's the writer. Mm. He is so good.
Joshua Harmon.
Oh, my God, he's so
incredible
good.
Incredible playwright.
And that's another thing, because I got that script, and it would took away my Fire Island Summer. I said, I'm not doing this script. And I said, no, agent, I'm not. And my kids read it. And both of them called me and said, Mom, you got to do this play. It's an important play. Yeah. I said, I'm going to miss the beach. Mom, you got to do it. And it was one of the best experiences of my life. They were a great group.
Yeah.
And that director, Trip Cullman, he is super duper.
Yeah.
He is such a good director. It was a great experience. But everybody talks about that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it was a really poignant
you
moment.
Know who said that? Joshua Harmon's grandmother.
Oh, really?
It's straight from her.
It's straight from life. Yeah.
It's what I'm saying sounds so interesting, and I never thought anything I did was all that interesting. It's so
it's interesting.
Oh, we're here to tell you it's interesting.
It's so interesting. But, you know, you don't think about yourself that much.
Right.
You think about
of course,
getting the groceries and picking up the kids, and you know. But it's fun. It's really been fun.
Well, my question is, you know, as you look back on the long book of your life,
yes,
what do you hope or want your legacy to be?
Are you talking in terms of life or in the theater?
Both.
Well, gosh, I don't know. I don't consider my center is my family, you know, my children, my grandchildren. And I just want them to be happy. That's what I'd like to leave them. One likes to live in such a way that you show them what could be. Even though I make mistakes all the time, everybody makes mistakes. As far as the theater is concerned, I think I've done what I needed to do. My husband used to say, it's your message to the world, Barbara. You know, he would say, I'd get a script, and he would say, it's not your message to the world, don't do it. And I did it once against his wishes, I won't tell you what it was, and I got fired. Because he said, it's not, I think, what you do as an artist when you leave, you think, maybe they'll remember I had a message to the world in some amorphous way. Do you think that's possible?
Yeah.
People look at, don't you look at other actors and you think, I know what they're saying? Like John Lithgow, I know what he's saying as a human being. That's it. You hope that your humanness and your act and your work come together. You hope. But who's going to remember? I mean... The stuff on film, they'll remember, right? And you never saw the original company, did you?
No, I was...
You were not born.
I was born in 1970. So, and it's the 50-year anniversary in the year... I'll be doing it when I turn 50. The year I turn 50.
You don't need...
I'm 49.
No.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Well, it's because of all the laughter you've provided me.
Oh,
over the years. So that's why I look so good.
I can't wait to see you.
Thank you.
Well, that's why I said I can say with a surety you're going to come to opening night, or at least we hope you'll come to opening night.
I hope I'm invited. Yeah. But you want my phone number at home so you can call me if you have any questions?
Yes.
I'll give it to you.
Okay.
It's 212.
Oh, God. Wait. Oh God.
I have one help more me. Piece Somebody before I go. 212.
Darling.
Yes.
Robert.
What?
I worry.
Why?
He's all alone. There's no one.
Where?
In his life.
Oh.
Robert ought to have a woman. Poor baby, all alone. Evening after evening by the telephone. We're the only tenderness he's ever known. Poor baby.
I'm serious. If you
Thank
get
you.
In the middle of rehearsal and you think, what do I do here? Just call me.
I will. Thank you.
That's what it's all about, isn't it? That's what it's really about. Isn't it? That's what it's really about. Really about.
Rob here with You May Be Wondering. During our interview with Barbara Barry, we referred a lot to a documentary about the original cast recording of Company. If you don't know, you may be wondering, what were they talking about? Well, for the uninitiated, in 1970, acclaimed documentary filmmaker D.A. Pennybaker shot a documentary about the recording of the original cast album for Company, called, appropriately enough, Original Cast Album, Company. It was the first in what was meant to be a series of documentaries for a TV series that would highlight the different ways that a cast album could be made. After filming and screening this first episode, the producers of the series abandoned the project to go on to lead a production in Hollywood, leaving behind a single 60-minute pilot episode about Company. It popped up from time to time over the years, shown on TV and at select theaters, before finally being released on DVD in 2000, an edition that is now unfortunately out of print. The film, though, the product of a forgotten idea, is today considered to be among the greatest theater documentaries ever made. As was a tradition at the time, the cast of Company recorded their album on the Sunday after their opening, which happened to be May 3rd, 1970. The session at Columbia Records' Big Church recording studio on East 30th Street and 3rd Avenue began at 10 a.m. that Sunday and went until 4:30 a.m. on Monday morning, a grueling 18-and-a-half-hour session that was one of the longest on record at that point. Following another tradition, the orchestra and the singers were recorded at the same time in the same room, adding additional pressure to an already intense experience. One mistake, and everyone had to start over. Employing his signature fly-on-the-wall direct cinema technique, in which there is no commentary or voiceover narration, Pennybaker unobtrusively observed the action with a tiny crew, catching on film the takes of songs now committed to history in their recorded form, and also capturing Stephen Sondheim, Hal Prince, and legendary record producer Thomas Z. Shepard interacting with the performers as everyone endeavors to create a definitive, lasting impression of the show that does it justice without the aid of book scenes or the visual trappings of the stage production. The documentary is most famous today for a scene involving Elaine Stritch's recording of her signature song, The Ladies Who Lunch. Late in the day, with her voice tired and probably under the influence, Stritch struggles to deliver a take that satisfies the creative team. They lower the key, but it lacks the right tension. As they prepare to start another take, Shepard says once more and sung, because Stritch is talking through the song too much. Cigarette in hand, she comes into the booth and asks for the key to be changed to what it is at the theater. As they listen back to a take, that cigarette still burning, running her hands through her messy hair, Stritch screams, "Wrong!" and "Oh, shut up!" to herself. After one last try, defeated, they lay down an orchestral track. And 3 days later, on Wednesday, between the matinee and the evening show, in full hair and makeup, Stritch comes back into the studio and in a single take, calmly and confidently records the final, iconic version that appears on the album. If you've never seen it, this documentary is a must for any serious musical theater fan. Two such fans, comedians John Mulaney and Seth Meyers, wrote a mockumentary version of the documentary earlier this year for the series Documentary Now, entitled Original Cast Album, Co-op, about the recording of the cast album for the fictional musical, Co-op. The parody meticulously reconstructs iconic moments and shots from the Pennybaker film and is quite hilarious. You should check it out. In 2001, a documentary about the making of the cast album of The Producers was filmed, capturing that experience just as Pennybaker had done for Company. As luck would have it, that same year, The Producers would also surpass Company's record 14 Tony Award nominations by earning 15. The first complete cast album to feature an original cast, chorus, and orchestra, and all the songs as heard in the theater, was Decca's recording of Oklahoma in 1943. Since then, original cast albums have become a staple of musical theater, emerging not only as beloved souvenirs for fans, but as essential documents of history, memorializing the sound and feel of a show, and, as was the case with Company, capturing a milestone in the development of the form. I personally consider it a crime against musical theater history when a new musical doesn't receive a cast recording, which happens usually because of expense, and most likely in the case of a flop. But to me, it's the flops that most need a recording, because that is how they can live on when productions are scarce or non-existent. The invaluable Encore series at New York City Center produces an annual season of staged concerts of forgotten or overlooked musicals. In addition to this important function for celebrating and promoting musical theater history, they've also created a number of cast albums over the years for shows that never had one in the first place, completing the record, no pun intended, and ensuring that fans and historians will have a document that they can reference in the future. And while cast albums might have fallen by the wayside from the height of the Golden Age, the emergence of streaming services and the thriving of niche media consumption has made albums like Hamilton, Dear Evan Hansen, and Be More Chill into chart toppers. Next time you listen to a cast album, think of Company. We love
Store chimes, in comes Company.
Over Here, that's our show. Thanks for listening. You can hear us anytime on iTunes, and if you like what you hear, rate and review us. The Fabulous Invalid is a production of O&M Etc. and The Fabulous Invalid LLC, and a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. Our theme music is by Lucky Chops. Today's episode was edited and engineered by Aaron Kaufman and Charles Van Kirk. You can find us online at thefabulousinvalid.com and on social media at Fabulous Invalid, and on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever you find your podcasts. And be sure to tune in next Wednesday.
What it's all about, isn't it? That's what it's really about, isn't it? That's what it's really about. Really about you, I love it, you, I love it, you, I love it, you, I love it.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.